Well, with the time change and all this morning, I'm pleased everyone got here. Some got here early, and that's good too. So I'm pleased about that. Just a quick little discussion. Last week we had a long talk about shepherds and sheep, and we talked about good shepherds, and we talked about the sheep of this fold and the sheep not of this fold. If you weren't here, that would be a good message to go listen to. Just go to the website. If you don't know how to get that, ask me and I'll tell you how to do that. But it's chapter 10 of John, of course. And it was related to both Jesus himself as the good shepherd, but he also made some pretty vital points about false shepherds. That study, if we were to do a study on shepherding, good shepherds, bad shepherds, false shepherds, whatever, that would take a whole hour's time. And so I would encourage, there's actually something on the website that I did a couple of years ago, which is useful for that as well. So you could listen to that if you want to hear more about that, or I can do another one of those sometime if we want. I also related it to Psalm 23, because I thought it was so important. You know, we hear Psalm 23, we always talk about it, we hear it read, we read it, beloved Psalm. But understanding the role of shepherds and how sheep think and how they react really adds a much deeper level of understanding for that psalm and the blessing God has for us as our shepherd, you know, and we as his sheep. So I would encourage you to go listen to that if you haven't. So today, are any questions about last week, by the way? Anything? Okay. So today we're going to move into another cycle, and this is really the beginning of the last week of Jesus' life. In terms of the Gospel of John. About the first half of John is focused on his life up until Passover, that Passover week. Then this session today starts the discussion that takes us through the crucifixion, the resurrection, and the appearances afterward. So John devotes a lot of time to that as opposed to, you know, the narrative part of Jesus did this, and then he did that, and he did this, and did that. So that's why I think John is considered a spiritual gospel, and why we should look at that. And Vicky's out confirming something for me right now, so I appreciate that for her. Something is beeping. Is that your phone? Okay, I thought maybe mine was going crazy here. So today we're going to talk about the raising of Lazarus. This is a discussion that we've all heard. Discussion we've all read, it's discussion we've had a lot of sermons preached on, so it's not an unfamiliar topic. If you remember from last week, Jesus was in the town of Bethany beyond Jordan. And I sent you a map. I don't have a good map here that I can show you big enough, but let me hold you up a map. I sent one out. But if you can picture for a second, see if I've got one big enough to show you anything.
Let me see if this one over there has it.
Here's one, Don. I can use this one, I think. Okay. So I sent you a map, and look at that. I'm going to send notes out that'll have that too. But you've got Sea of Galilee, you've got the Dead Sea, and you've got Israel along here. And, you know, Galilee's at the top, and the old thing of Israel is down here. And Jerusalem, as a point, is here. Bethlehem is down here, and Bethany is kind of in the middle to the right, the Bethany where Mary and Lazarus and Martha lived. But Jesus is over here in what's called modern-day Jordan, but he was in a little town called Bethany, you know, across the Jordan, or Bethany on the other side of the Jordan. What?
East Jordan.
Yeah, he's in East Jordan.
East Bethany, that is.
East Bethany. So that sort of sets the stage for where they are. Bethany itself, the one where Martha and Mary lived, is about 2 miles from Jerusalem. If you continue in that direction and go another 5 miles, you reach Bethlehem. So those of you that have been to Israel and you stand on the Mount of Olives and you face the Temple Mount, probably all of us that have been there have done that, you're sort of facing from south to north. You're facing the north, kind of the northeast. But behind you, about a mile and a half is Bethany, and another 5 miles approximately is Bethlehem. So that kind of sets the parameters of where we are. The Bethany beyond the Jordan is about 20 miles from there, and it's on the other side of the Jordan River, and as I say, even in Jordan. So the whole story of Lazarus is very well known to us. I mean, it's, you know, there are so many things that creep into our culture from biblical stories many people don't understand. You know, they'll talk about somebody seeing the writing on the wall. Well, they don't really realize where that comes from. The other thing they talk about is, you know, if you've got some friend that you haven't seen in 20 years and they come walking through the door, you'll say, well, here's Lazarus returning from the dead, you know. And people use that term. I've even known people that have had cats named Lazarus, you know, nine lives and all that stuff. But, you know, it's not a name we typically will name a kid today is Lazarus. I mean, I'm sure there are some, but Lazarus is a Greek name, by the way. The Hebrew name for Lazarus is Eleazar. So you've heard of Eleazar. You read the Bible, you hear of Eleazar. That's the Hebrew name for Lazarus. And it means God has helped or God is my help. So pretty fitting name for the character Lazarus. You know, God has helped for sure in Lazarus's life. This story has many lessons for us, and I can't even begin to cover them all. At other times, I've taught this in two sessions. I'm going to try to do it all in one today. But I'm going to also send some information out. There's about eight things that I think are real important to understand. I'm going to talk through them this morning as we go. But there's more than that. I'm not going to get as deep in this as I could get. But there's more to this scripture. And there's a lot of deep truths that we should get to it. As I sent in the note out, I said that I was going to send out this information after the class, and I will. I don't want you reading it now while we're in class, so I'll send it out afterwards. So if you picture the map and you picture where we are, we're going to start in John chapter 11. And if you'll look in your Bibles there, we'll start that narrative. I'm going to read a couple of sentences, then I'm going to pull off to the side of the road and talk for a minute about what we should understand. John chapter 11, verse 1. Now a man named Lazarus was sick. He was from Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. This Mary, whose brother Lazarus now lay sick, was the same one who poured perfume on the Lord and wiped his feet with her hair. So the sisters sent word to Jesus, Lord, the one you love is sick. A couple of things here. One is, I've already talked about Bethany. The whole thing about Mary pouring the perfume on Jesus' feet, we'll read next week. So John is giving just a little hint of it before he gets to that part of his gospel. Because, you know, he wrote this as the last gospel. So everybody had read the others, of which it's all in there. So he's just pointing that out, that it's the same. A lot of Marys, by the way, in the Bible. You know, Miriam is really the Hebrew name for Mary. So Miriam is Hebrew for Mary. And, you know, Maria is, you know, sort of the Spanish in the Italian version. So a lot of different names for Mary, but I'm not sure about Martha. I didn't look that one up. But Mary and Martha were friends of Jesus. And as an aside, Jesus used their home, must have been a fairly good sized home, as a stopping point. And whenever he was coming from Galilee, he would stay at the home of Mary and Martha in Bethany because it was a very short trip into Jerusalem. Plus, they were friends. He was friends with them and with Lazarus. And all of the disciples stayed there, so it must have been a big place. And it was very easy for him to get to and very easy for him to stay. It was almost like a home away from home for him. And so Jesus was not at that town, but he was at the other Bethany, 20 miles away. So Lazarus is sick. He's not dead yet, but he's sick. And when he gets to near the point of death, Mary and Martha decide they need to send for Jesus. So they do. So they get somebody to go talk to him. But it's about a day and a half's journey to get from one Bethany to the other one. Maybe a little less if you hurry, but 20 miles in the country, this is not flat paved roads. It looks like this. And, you know, it's a lot of crooks and narrows. And 20 miles as the crow flies. I don't know what the walking path would be to get there. But it was about a day and a half walk. So they got there, and so Jesus was over where John the Baptist had baptized him. And if you recall, let me just give you a little side piece of information. John the Baptist everyone believes was an Essene. And if you don't know what an Essene was a sect of Jews that were around Qumran, and they were very monastic. They didn't hang out with the other Jews. They didn't like the what they thought was the showmanship of the other Jews. They were very religious, but very almost like monks. You know, they were in their little place, and they like primitive Baptists would be today. You know, no music. Somebody just gets up and talks, and just very plain and simple. And that was John the Baptist. Of course, you know, he wore camel's hair kind of outfit and lived in the wilderness. So it's kind of what you'd expect. So he was over there close to where John the Baptist ministered. And so, verse 4, when he heard this, Jesus said, "This sickness will not end in death." He knows the beginning from the end. We don't know that yet because we're just reading it. This sickness will not end in death. No, it's for God's glory, so that God's Son may be glorified through it. And so you ask yourself, why was Lazarus sick? He gives us the answer here. It was to demonstrate God's glory, and in demonstrating God's glory, to demonstrate the glory of God's Son, who would use that as a method to gain glory. So just kind of file that away, because we're going to see that again in a second. But of the eight truths I want to bring out to you, two of them are here. First one is, illness or death is a place where we can discover new attributes of God. You know, sometimes when we're on the mountaintop, we don't see the depth of what God has for us. But when we're in despair, in the valley of the shadow of death, when we're in a place like that, we begin to see God able to minister to us. You know, when the Terrys gave their testimony, you saw that. Because when they were in the deepest part of the valley, then God ministered them. And it showed them a whole new side of God that maybe they knew about, but it wasn't alive in their mind. Now it's alive in their mind because of what they went through. So, you know, when we have those kind of situations, and we all do in our lives, one of the things we ought to think about is, what is God revealing to me here about himself that I need to pay attention to? The other thing is the term glory and glorified here, we've talked about before, comes from the Greek word doxa. And, you know, we sing doxologies. We don't do it much anymore, but we used to sing doxologies every Sunday morning in church. And the doxology is really a way of glorifying or praising God for everything we have, who we are, what we are, the fact that we can come worship him. And, you know, the question then comes about, like with Mary and Martha, can we praise God? Can we glorify God in all circumstances, good and bad? I mean, that's hard for us. You know, we'll glorify him when things are going well, but do we glorify him when things aren't going well? Are we thankful for some of the things that happen in our lives and expectant for what he's going to do for us? So there's two things just to file away in terms of truths we can learn. So verse 5 says, "Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister Mary and Lazarus." So Jesus loved Martha, you know, he loved Mary, and he loved Lazarus. He loved all three of them. And then we see a kind of a strange little verse. "So when he heard that Lazarus was sick, he stayed where he was 2 more days. So it took a day and a half to get there. He's now spent 2 more days. It's been 3.5 days now. And then he says to his disciples, "Let's go back to Judea." So remember, you can't see it from the map I showed you, but Jerusalem, in today's world, Jerusalem is in Israel. But right outside of Jerusalem, both north and south, is what is called the West Bank. It's sort of disputed territory. We would call it Judea and Samaria, biblical terms. Judea was the tribe that had Jerusalem and had the territory right around Jerusalem and then south. And so the disciples are puzzled. Why are we going to go back to Judea? You know, and they say, you know, he says, "Let's go back to Judea." And they, in verse 8, it says, "But Rabbi, they said a short while ago the Jews were trying to stone you, and yet you are going to go back to Judea." Two more truths here. One of them is, God sometimes asks us to wait. And I would just say here, waiting on God waiting for God may be the will of God. And this was the will of God, that he wait. They were waiting on God for him to come. He was waiting for God where he was, and then he was going to go do the will of God, which was when he got to Bethany. So that's important. And the other thing, and this came to mind this week for me, I've had, don't want to get off in side discussions, but I've got two listings that I'm working on right now. And of course, it goes for days and nothing happens. And then all of a sudden, 30 things happen within 20 minutes, and you're kind of going, you can't get everything confirmed, and you have that in your life. Sometimes you are at home and you have nothing to do, and then the next 2 days you'd have no time. You're busy every single second. But we notice with Jesus, he's never rushed. He doesn't say, "Oh my gosh, I got to get up and head over there now." You know, he never does that. If you look all through the gospel, Jesus is never rushed. We never see him in a hurry. Panic attacks and anxiousness don't crowd his life. You know, maybe we should take a cue from that and sort of slow down and listen for God and wait on God. Somebody have something to say over here? A hand?
He knows it all.
Yeah, well, he does. We don't know it all. He knows it all. But Rabbi, a short while ago they were trying to stone you, and yet you are going back to Jerusalem. Now, Jesus answers in verse 9 a really kind of a strange answer. I'm going to explain it to you, but listen to it. Jesus answered, "Are there not 12 hours of daylight? Anyone who walks in the daytime will not stumble or falter, for they see by this world's light. It is when a person walks at night that they stumble, for they have no light." You're thinking, what does one have to do with the other right here? But understand for a minute, Jesus is making a couple of points here that are pretty important. One of them is, when he says, "For they see by the world's light," that's the NIV translation. Some of your translations may say something like, "For they see by the light of the world." And I think if you use the light of the world, when we hear somebody talk about the light of the world, what do we know they're talking about? We know they're talking about Jesus, the light of the world. We sing that every Christmas, but we also should know that. So there's a little deeper meaning here for this. And Jesus' question to them is, are there not 12 hours in a day? Well, we look at that and we say, well, you know, what does that mean? I mean, look at our days, longer, shorter. We just set the clocks back. In Roman and biblical times, here's what they did. The day was the day, and there was 12 hours in a day. So however many, what we would call hours of daylight, they divided by 12, and each one of those was an hour. So where we have a 60-minute hour and we've frozen that, and our daylight times go in and out with, you know, with daylight savings time, they did it the other way. They froze the day, and there was 12 hours in the day. So Jesus is saying, aren't there not 12 hours in the day? And that says each day has its own set of hours. Nothing is going to finish before it begins. It's going to start with hour one, go to hour two, hour three, hour four, so that each day has its own time. He's also making a point that, you know, that we do things in the daytime, and that's the time we have to work. And he also makes the point that in that 12 hours, there's really enough time for us to do what has to be done, because there will be a time when it becomes dark and we can't do it anymore. The other kind of subtle point here is that there's 12 hours in a day, no more, no less, in their time. We don't always know when the day is going to end for us, because he makes a comparison to light and dark. Not just physical days and physical nights, but light and dark. We saw in John chapter 1 where he begins this discussion of light and dark, and everything that is light is of God and from God and through God and by God. Everything that is darkness is away from God. And you know, and the darkness will not overcome the light. So we understand the concept of spiritual darkness and spiritual light. He's making the side point here or there that says, there will be a time when the spiritual light ends and the spiritual darkness begins. And for us, we don't know when that is. I mean, for us, that spiritual daylight ends when we die and go home to be with the Lord. Our time in the daylight is gone. Then we're past that point. We're in the night. Spiritual night. So nobody gets more time. Nobody can send a note and say, "Hey, I know it's dark, but I want an extra 36 hours It's just not going to work. That's not the way salvation works. That's not the way God has it planned. They didn't have watches, so they couldn't look at the time and see what 60 minutes were. So that's the reason they did what they did. I guess the question for us is, you know, do we want the glory of being there on time, or do we want the tragedy of being too late and getting there when it's dark? It should give us a little bit of a sense of urgency for not only ourselves, but for our loved ones and our friends. You know, we sort of understand the timing is getting towards the end of the time of the church age. Nobody knows dates or anything like that, but the signs are all there for us, and it should increase our willingness, our eagerness, and our desire to witness to others, because the time is short. And when the door shuts, time is over for them in terms of that. So, you know, just like Noah preached for 120 years, nobody came. And when the time came for the flood, the Lord came and he shut the door. Metaphorically, no one else was getting in the ark. For us, when God calls us home and when we're raptured out, you know, that time, the time of light is gone. There's a little time left in the 7 years, but there's a delusion that comes, and that's a whole other subject. But the point is, there's a time to do things, and there's a time that you can't do anything. And he's sort of making that clear to them. Verse 11, after he had said this, he went on to tell them, our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I'm going there to wake him up. Now, falling asleep, we know from the New Testament, is kind of a Christian metaphor for dying in the Lord. And but the disciples, you know, at this point didn't understand that. And he says he's going to go there to wake him up. So they think, okay, he's going to wake him up. He's asleep. He's going to wake him up. So his disciples replied, Lord, if he sleeps, literal sleep, he'll get better. Jesus had been speaking of his death, but his disciples thought he meant natural sleep, which he didn't. So Jesus then tells them plainly, and I can just see Jesus saying, okay, let me be clear. Lazarus is dead. D-E-A-D, dead. And for your sake, I'm glad I was not there so that you may believe, but let's go to him. So I can picture now, and maybe this is because of the times we live in, I picture the headlines. Lazarus dead, Jesus glad he wasn't there. I mean, that's what you'd see, right? And then you read the article and you discover that's not at all what was said. But, you know, I don't know why I thought of that, but it's just in the day and time we live in, that's what we could expect. But the fuller reading of this is pretty clear. For your sake, I'm glad I was not there so that you may believe, but let us go to him. 16, then Thomas, good old Thomas, also known as Didymus. Both of those, by the way, Didymus and Thomas both mean twin. So then Thomas, also known as Didymus, said to the rest of the disciples, well, let us also go that we may die with him. You know, sign me up, coach. You know, I'm ready to go. Ever eager, Thomas. The truth number five, though, says sorrow creates the perfect environment for us to grow in our faith. I mean, everybody was going to be sorrowful, and we're going to see that when he gets to, you know, to where the sisters are. 17, on his arrival, so now he leaves. It's been, what, 3.5 days. So he leaves and he's on his way, and probably on the fourth day he gets there, or fifth day, I don't know. It's hard to, you know, say when he left and when he, you know, walked 20 hours. I don't know how long that took. But it's long past 3 days. And on his arrival, Jesus found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb for 4 days. That's important, and I'm going to talk about that in a minute. Now, Bethany was less than 2 miles from Jerusalem, and many Jews had come to Martha and Mary to comfort them in the loss of their brother. So we see a couple of things here. One is Mary and Martha were well known in Jerusalem. They were probably wealthy. They had a big house. They were kind of considered, upper crust, I guess, in the terms of the Jews that were not Pharisees. And so they were well known, and a lot of the people probably liked them because they were very likable. So many Jews had come out and traveled the 2 miles to show their respects and their bereavement. When Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went out to meet him, but Mary stayed home. it's kind of interesting, you know, Mary and Martha. We, you know, I'm sure all you ladies have had the Mary and Martha stories, you know, what they talk about, the characteristics of Mary and the characteristics of Martha. So Martha runs out to meet him, and she says to him, "Oh my gosh, Lord, I'm so thankful you've been here. You know, we've been praying for you to come." Is that what she says? No. She says, "Lord, if you'd been here, my brother would not have died." It's on her mind. "And but I know that even now God will give you whatever you ask." So we know Martha was the ever-busy Martha. You know, she cooked, she cleaned, she prepared, she fixed. She did all the things people who are very busy like that do. Mary was more sanguine. You know, she kind of lived for the moment. And, you know, she was there to fellowship. She was there to talk. She was there to eat. She was there to share. You know, Martha was too busy to do any of that. And there's a lot of things you could make about that, but I'll leave it alone. Jesus says to her, says to Martha, "Your brother will rise again." And Martha says, "I know he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day." So the Jews had this view of resurrection. I mean, they didn't have any idea about Jesus' death and resurrection. They didn't have any warning of the Holy Spirit. They didn't have any warning of the whole coming of the Christian community. All they knew was what the rabbis taught them. And the rabbis taught them is at the end, when the Messiah comes, he will raise all the faithful Jews to resurrection, to live with God. And so that's what they thought. And she says, "Yeah, I know. When the resurrection comes, he will be raised to life." And Jesus doesn't let that pass. He says to her, another one of the I Ams, "I am the resurrection and the life. The one who believes in me will live even though they die. And whoever lives by believing in me will never die. Do you believe this?" Now, we know he's talking about physical death and spiritual death. And we also understand that if you're born twice, you die once. If you're born physically and spiritually, then your spirit life never dies. Your physical life does. But if you're not born again, not born spiritually, then both of those lives die when you die. So he's getting at that right now. And she says, "Yes, Lord, I believe that you are the Messiah, the Son of God, who is to come into the world." So she confirms what she understands about him. And she went back and called her sister Mary aside and said, "The teacher or the rabbi is here, and he's asking for you." We don't see Jesus asking for her, but he may have said, you know, "Where's Mary?" And she said, "I'll go get her." When Mary heard this, she got up quickly and went to him. So she was perfectly content in the house with all the worshipers and the grievers and the mourners and all that. But when she heard the Lord wanted her, she was up and out. And now Jesus had not yet entered the village, but was still at the place where Martha had met him. So he had come, Martha had met him, and he stayed there. And he waited for Mary to come. And she did. As soon as she got the word, she was like, you know, pop-up poster. She was up and out. And so Mary says to him, "Oh gosh, Lord, we're thankful for you to come." No. When Mary reached him where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet and said, "Lord, if you'd been here, my brother would not have died." And you think Mary and Martha had this conversation before? I suspect they were reading out of the same little playbook of what they were going to say to Jesus when he came. They had no concept, really, of why he was coming to do what he was due. And that really sets the stage for the most miraculous thing that is going to happen. But when in verse 33, when Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews who had come along with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in spirit and troubled. So here's the situation. She pops up. The Jews who are there see her pop up, and they decide she's going to go to the tomb and mourn there. So they get up and they follow her. But she doesn't go to the tomb. She goes to where Jesus is. So Jesus stand there, Mary and Martha, all the Jews around. Mary falls at his feet. Mary's very emotional, out emotional, you know, public emotion. So she falls at his feet, weeping, and says, "You know, if you had been here, my brother wouldn't have died." And Jesus was deeply moved in spirit and troubled. These two words are different. You may look at them and think they're the same. Moved in spirit says that he felt really sorrow for her. in his spirit. You know, he was sad for her to be grieving. Troubled is the word that means he was visibly upset. So you can look at somebody and see when they're visibly upset because their demeanor changes. So both Jesus' demeanor had changed and his heart had changed. He was upset about her weeping, and his spirit was disturbed, but he was also visibly shaken. You know, when you get word, or maybe more personal, after a family member has passed and you walk into the funeral home for the first time and you see the family member, normally that is a time reserved just for the family because it's a difficult time. You're faced with the reality that that person is dead. And so, you know, Jesus is now, he's known about it, but he's faced with a human emotion. I mean, he's fully human, remember. Faced with a fully human emotion of watching somebody grieve. None of us who love somebody can watch them be in tears without feeling that hard emotion to be in tears ourselves. Jesus was no different. But he says to Mary, "Where have you laid him?" When Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews who had come along with her also weeping, that's kind of interesting, he was deeply moved in spirit and troubled. Okay, so we just read that. And she says to him, when he says, "Where have you laid him?" She says, "Come and see, Lord." Now, the most famous verse in the Bible that kids memorize is, "Jesus wept." Shortest verse in the Bible. But the word for wept here doesn't mean, by the way, one tear rolling down the cheek. It means openly weeping. You know, a lot of tears, a lot of emotion. It doesn't mean falling down, you know, butting your head against the wall, but it does mean open sorrow with a lot of tears. So Jesus is weeping at this as well. So, and then the Jews saw how Jesus reacted and wept with all of his free-flowing tears, and they saw his appearance and knew these were not crocodile tears. Any of you know what crocodile tears are?
Big tears. CNN.
Yeah, I see any tear. Well, if you watch preachers on TV, I won't pick any names, but if you watch them on TV, they will reach a very emotional part of their sermon, and they'll go, and tears will come rolling down their cheeks, you know, and it's kind of like, press the button, the tears roll. Those are crocodile tears. They're not tears of emotion. They're tears of convenience. They're tears of showmanship. They're tears of all of that. Those were not Jesus' tears. Jesus' tears were not, he wasn't putting on a show for Mary and Martha and the Jews. He was sincerely troubled and sincerely weeping. And the Jews saw that, and they said in verse 36, "See how he loved him."
Going back to he groaned in the spirit, that was really deep.
That's deep. That's really deep. And we know, you know, the spirit, which translation is that, by the way?
King James.
Groaned in the Spirit. We know one of the tasks of the Holy Spirit, if you've ever done a study on the Holy Spirit, is to hear our inner groanings that we can't even verbalize and take them to the Lord. Mm-hmm. So we can groan in our spirit. I mean, Jesus groans in his spirit. He's groaning straight to the Lord. When we groan in our spirit, the Holy Spirit takes those and relays them, even if we don't have words for them. That's a real good translation for that. I don't normally use that one, but that's a good translation for that. Thank you. But even some of the Jews said in verse 37, "Couldn't he who opened the eyes of the blind man have kept this man from dying?" They all had this vision that if Jesus had gotten there in time, he could have healed him. But now that time had passed, it was beyond the pale. He couldn't do anything. So truth number six here is for believers, we're going to see this in a minute, but truth number six is, for believers, there's life beyond the grave. We talked about before, you know, if you're born twice, you only die once. And the other truth, truth seven, is for unbelievers, if you're only born once, then you die twice. And that's kind of that's pretty deep spiritual thought, but he brings this out. So Jesus, once more deeply moved, came to the tomb. It was a cave with a stone laid across the entrance. And he says, "Take away the stone." "But Lord," Martha says, "sister of the dead man, by this time there's a bad odor, for he has been there for 4 days." So let me just step back for a minute and talk about this whole scene. So picture for a minute, they're all gathered around the tomb. Jesus, Mary and Martha, all the Jews that have come to mourn. They're all, I don't know how many are there, but they're all gathered around the tomb. Jesus walks up and says, "Roll away the stone." Now, the Jews, like Middle Easterners today, when someone died, and they may embalm in Jerusalem today, but at that day and time they did not. Muslims still don't. If you die, you're going to be buried that evening because that's just the way it is. They wipe the body down, they wrap it, and they bury it. And that was a Middle Eastern custom. So I assume for Lazarus it was that way. So the day he died, he was buried. Typically what they did was they wrapped him in cloth, linen. They put, just like they did Jesus, they put, aromatic things around the cloth and wrapped him up in that because the stink got pretty bad after a few days. And they put a cloth, a linen piece over the face. And that's the way they would lay him in the tomb. And the Jews had this idea that after the third day, the body began to deteriorate, the face began to deteriorate, everything began to deteriorate. And they believed for the first 3 days after death that the spirit of the deceased hovered over the body looking for a way back in. But at the end of the 3 days, when the flesh started to decay, the spirit basically said, "Okay, he's dead. I'm going where I'm supposed to go." And the spirit leaves. And Jews believed all that. And if you go now to Jerusalem and you go, how many of you have been to the Garden Tomb? Okay, so I don't know whether you noticed this or not. I'm sure your guide didn't point it out to you. But if you look at the Garden Tomb and you go inside the Garden Tomb, just as it mentions later at his crucifixion, the area on the right is where they laid the body, which was unusual for a tomb then, by the way. Normally it was in the back. So on the right and then to the left was the preparation room where they would wrap the body and take him in and then lay him up in this area. Then they would come out. And if you go in, that's the way it looks. But if you look up, there's a hole in the rock. It's about this big. It's a hole in the rock. And the Jews call this the soul window. I mean, it's kind of superstitious. I mean, the soul doesn't need to go through a hole in the rock, just like Jesus didn't need to have the rock rolled away to walk out. But it was rolled away, and in this one, they put the hole there because that's what they believed. So picture the fact that after 3 days, the body starts to deteriorate, and then the soul calls it quits and exits out the top of the hole and goes where souls go. So let me tell you where souls go. In the Old Testament, there was a place called Sheol. In the New Testament, there's a place called Hades, and they are the same place. They're the resting place of souls. So when you died in that day and time, your body went into the grave and your soul went to this resting place of souls. And, there were two chambers in it. And you know the story of, Abraham's bosom and Lazarus and all that in the Old Testament. But so the spirit would leave and go to this resting place of souls and await further instructions. So that's what they knew. That's what they believed. And so... Jesus then says in verse 40, "Did I not tell you that if you believe, you will see the glory of God?" So they took away the stone, and Jesus looked up and said, "Father, I thank you that you've heard me. I knew that you always hear me, but I said this for the benefit of the people standing here, that they may believe you sent me." So Jesus is beginning to say why he's going to do what he's going to do. And he's doing it to show the glory of God and show them that it's not only glory for God, but it's glory for the Son who's going to do the work. When he said this, Jesus called in a loud voice, "Lazarus, come out." Actually, if you translate those words literally, if you go into like Young's literal translation or whatever, it says, "Lazarus, out here." Out here. And they formalize it a little nicer and say, "Come out." And what happened next? The dead man came out, hands and feet wrapped with strips of linen and cloth around his face. So, I mean, they're all standing there. They roll the stone away. Jesus calls Lazarus. And if you've ever watched any of the Hollywood apocalypse movies, you sort of think, out comes Lazarus wrapped in grave clothes, coming out the door. Their eyes are probably this big. Their mouth is hanging down. And so he comes walking out of the grave. The linen cloth still on his face. We know Jesus took it off when he was resurrected. Therefore, many of the Jews who had come to visit Mary had seen what Jesus had done, believed in him, but some of them went to the Pharisees and told them what Jesus had done. Then the chief priests and Pharisees called a meeting of the Sanhedrin. Truth 8. This is an important one for all of us. No matter what miracle, no matter what sign, there'll be some who believe and some who don't. And even today, there's some people you can witness to. They can have a miraculous thing happen in their life, and they still won't come to the Lord. And that's just the way it is. That's the way people are. So no matter how sincere our heart is, no matter how sincere they appreciate the miracle or the sign, there's a whole gap between that sincerity and coming to faith in the Lord. Tragically, blindness, deafness, hardness of hearts, deceptive people are still around us everywhere. We see them every day. Our job is to continue to woo them to the Spirit, be pleasant to them, pray for them, but we can't be surprised if they don't come. Each one of them has to make their own decision to step forward. There's nothing we can do to make them do that. Sad as that is. Good in one way, because we don't have the guilt for that. Sad in another way, in that there's nothing we can do but, you know, pray for them and just pray somebody will come to their life or some situation will come into their life. Verse 51. I skipped a verse. Verse 49. Then one of them, one of the priests is talking about here, named Caiaphas. Also skipped another verse, 48. It says, what are we accomplishing? They ask. Here's the man performing many signs. If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him. It's kind of interesting, isn't it? I mean, the whole thing was to get Jesus to make them believe, and everything he does is making it work. And the Jews, who are the religious leaders of the day, are going to fight that to the death. And everyone will believe in him, and then the Romans will come and take away both our temple and our nation. We see clearly their priority is not the people. Their priority is not following God or honoring God. Their priority is their power and their structure as the keepers of the kingdom for the Jewish temple there. And that's kind of a sad thing. It really validates the fact that Jesus called them false shepherds, and they really are. And that's the big characteristic of a false shepherd, is that they really are out for themselves. They're not out for the sheep. They'll only do something for the sheep if it benefits themselves. So that's the big characteristic. Then one of them named Caiaphas, we know him from later on, he was the high priest that year, spoke up. So in the Roman Empire, they rotated high priests every year. And typically it was Caius, it was his son. They rotated in a close group because the Romans didn't want the high priest to gain a lot of power. So they rotated him out. So Caiaphas was high priest that year, high priest during the time of Jesus' crucifixion as well. And he speaks up and he says, you guys, you know nothing at all. You don't realize that it's better for you that one man die for the people than the whole nation perish. And I would just say every preacher who's preached this sermon will tell you, you know, what a prophetic saying that is. He's unwittingly pronouncing the judgment on the people that he's got, because he's prophesying that Jesus will die for the people so that the nation won't perish. But the nation won't be with God. It'll just be alive. It won't be with God. And it won't last very long at that. So 51 says, he didn't say this on his own, but as high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the Jewish nation, and not only for that nation, but also for the scattered children of God, to bring them together and make them one. So from that day on, they plotted to take his life. So we see that this is a prophecy, we know this, a prophecy for the nations, not just for the Jews. For the scattered Jews, they've been brought back or they're being brought back, but also for the Gentiles that will come to know him. Whoever's a child of God, this promise applies to. We're all children of God if we've accepted him and had that new birth. And he will bring them together and make them one. If you remember last week, I drew a little sketch and talked about how, you know, when Christianity appeared, that was the only path left to heaven. So a Jew or a Muslim or a Gentile of any stripe had to become a Christian to get that bridge into heaven. And he reaffirms that here. Therefore, Jesus no longer moved around publicly among the people of Judea. Instead, he withdrew to a region near the wilderness to a village called Ephraim, where he stayed with his disciples. They don't really know where Ephraim is, but it's sort of a way outside of Bethany, about 30 miles, I guess. So it's kind of up more in the barren areas. And so that's, nobody knows exactly. They'll find evidence someday, but they haven't yet, as far as I know. So, when it was almost time for the Jewish Passover, so it's spring now, it's getting spring, many went up from the country to Jerusalem for their ceremonial cleansing before the Passover. They kept looking for Jesus, and as they stood in the temple courts, where he preached all the time, they asked one another, "What do you think? Isn't he coming to the festival at all?" But the chief priests and the Pharisees had given orders that anyone who found out where he was should report it so that they might arrest him. So the Pharisees were waiting also for him. And I guess we're about done. So what do we take away from this? One thing I think we take away is Jesus healed many people of many things, you know, issues of blood, blind, lame, you know, withered arm. You can go through all the Gospels and put a category of the miracles he did. But he raised Lazarus